OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. And also by AFSCME Local 3336, representing the employees of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality by advocating for working conditions, pay and benefits, supporting political activity that promotes pro-environment and pro-labor positions, strengthening labor coalitions, and actively organizing members. More information at AFSCME3336.org. This KBOO.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, a weekly program about working people, the labor movement, and organizing on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Don McIntosh. Tonight's show is about inequality. It's a two-part show. On the first part, we'll be talking with Jim Lardner, one of the editors of a new book, Inequality Matters, The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequences. In the second half of the hour, a recorded interview with Tamara Drought, who was in Portland last week, to talk about her book, Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Seem to Get Ahead. That's in the second half of the hour. Now we're joined by phone. Jim Lardner, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Jim, just let me say a word or two of introduction. You, in fact, like Tamara Drought, who we'll be hearing from at the end of the show, are a senior fellow at Demos. Is it a new think action tank?
5 years old, which is fairly new. One of a number of organizations that's been founded by people hoping to kind of produce a counterweight to the whole right-wing think tank apparatus.
And for those who want to find out more, that's Demos, DEMOS.org, is that right?
Yes, it is.
And again, based in New York City, and bills itself as a think action tank.
Yes, our causes are expanding the democracy, expanding opportunity, building community.
Your book, just out, Inequality Matters, the Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequences, it draws from a number of fairly well-known progressive thinkers to talk about, you know, what it says, economic divide in America. Where did you get the idea for putting together a project like this?
We started out by having a conference on this subject in June of 2004, and the idea, I had myself started a website some years ago, inequality.org, which was meant to be a resource for people interested in the growth of economic inequality. And the goal, the conference, and the goal of the book are in some ways the same, which is, this has been going on for 30 years. For God's sake, let's stop and pause and look at the results. This is a profound change that has occurred in America that kind of slipped in under the media radar, and it's been going on for this very long time. Other stories have always seemed more important, so, you know, our attention has never been squarely on this. But we've now had a steadily increasing concentration of wealth and income to the point that the United States is not only a more unequal society than it has been since the 1930s, but also the most unequal in terms of wealth or income of all the developed nations of the world today.
And becoming more so all the time.
Yes.
You know, we think in terms of, you know, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. Is that in fact happening?
That's not the best description of what's happened, in the sense, if we go back to the late 70s when this trend started, you find periods of time in which the rich were getting richer and the poor were getting poorer in the aggregate. But by and large, what's been happening has been the rich pulling away from everybody else, from the middle and from the bottom. And you can say, if you just look at dollar statistics, you can say that both middle-class Americans and low-income Americans have not been gaining much at all in the aggregate. And of course, many poor people have gotten poorer, but in the aggregate, you're talking about something more like stagnation or slow improvement in fortunes, except for one big except, which is that as these dollar differences have grown, so has the realm of life that is ruled by the dollar: healthcare, higher education. People are in a number of areas, now face skyrocketing costs that they are increasingly expected to pay out of their own pockets. Even though you see a lot of people managing to sort of stay in the middle class in terms of consumption, it's at the cost of working longer hours and incurring heavy debt and not having much time with their family and all kinds of other costs that economists sometimes miss.
Jim Lardner, you're a journalist, and you've written in the past for the New York Review of Books, the New Yorker, Washington Post, The Nation, New York Times Magazine. Do you think the media is covering this adequately at this point, this polarization that we're seeing?
No, I don't. However, in I think the last year or two, there's been a big improvement, a big glomming onto the story, you might say, that has begun with the major newspapers, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, all have run major series in the last year, year and a half about either growing inequality or growing income and economic volatility and risk. Or declining opportunity, and that you might say is kind of the saddest, one of my nominees for the two saddest aspects of this unacknowledged national tragedy, as I consider it, as the co-authors of this book consider it. We have always liked to think of ourselves as a land of opportunity, as the place where how you start out in life or who your forebears were matters very little or matters the least, really, to how far you can go. And sadly, the American dream of upward mobility is now less of a reality in America itself than it is in many of the countries of Europe, the old aristocratic societies that we were supposed to be so different from.
And maybe we're becoming a new aristocratic society. I want to talk about that in a second. So, but you're saying class mobility is down. So maybe where the myth was or the reality for some of rags to riches, maybe it's just rags to ranch house at this point and you don't get to go much higher.
Rags to ranch house, I like it. People who've tracked how many Americans or what proportion of Americans move up the ladder, especially from the lower rungs to the higher rungs, see it declining. And that, you know, kind of matches a lot of what we see and have experienced when we look at the explosion of those who occupy the least attractive jobs and the least well-paid jobs really are not presented with any career ladder or any opportunity for improvement. And then, of course, the sharp divide between the opportunities available to people with a four-year college degree or better and the opportunities available to the rest of the population. That's a very steep divide now in America.
But again, on the whole, the poor, the middle class, basically holding their ground at best, some losing out, maybe some getting a little ahead. But in terms of the greater productivity of our society today, most of that growth is being somehow, taken by the very top, the top 1%, the top 5%.
Yeah, and even the top one, as you say, in today's New York Times, Paul Krugman has a column in which he points out that it is the top 1% and even who I don't remember the figure, something like 487% income growth over the last 20 years. It's astonishing at that level. And he notes that this statistical pattern really refutes the broad claim of a lot of experts, including the new Fed chairman who testified to this effect recently, that we're talking about some kind of skills gap that technology demands higher education and that we haven't been able to keep up with the need, and that accounts for this inequality because it's really concentrated in a tiny percentage of the population, or the top 1% is where the most extreme gains occur. By the way, CEOs and these people way up there on the ladder are not necessarily people with terrific college education credentials. But in any case, if you look at how they're making their money, it doesn't really have a whole lot to do with.
Yeah, where do you go to school to become a Fortune 500 CEO?
I should have that answer at Tappan, and I don't.
I'm not sure school is really the answer at that level.
Right.
So what's behind this? I mean, it's, you know, again, a consistent trend, you know, 10, 20, 30 years now. What would you say is the biggest cause of this polarization we're talking about?
I think that America chose to be a more unequal society and was more conscious on the part of some of us than others. This process started in the 70s. You remember, at that time, corporate America was struggling with inflation and with oil prices and a general feeling of loss of competitiveness. And one of the solutions to this dilemma was to try and reclaim a certain kind of power over the rest of society that owners of big corporations had before the Depression and the New Deal. There was a pent-up feeling of resentment against all of the public investment and the regulation and the social programs of that whole generation from the early 30s through the 60s. And there were, of course, real objections that people had to some of the excesses of regulation. But it was put together into a very conscious strategy. You see a lot of books and papers being written in the 60s and 70s by conservative thinkers who said, let's pour money, let's get business, in fact, to pour money into a new apparatus of think tanks and journals and that will breed, and college professorships and schools, that will breed a whole new generation of policy makers and policies. And this has had very tangible results. We have the whole era of deregulation and privatization and the attack on big government and the somewhat, well, not just somewhat, the very, very misleading calls for tax relief for all Americans, which has really been a label that has excused a huge tax shift in the tax burden away from the very wealthy to middle-class Americans. Anyhow, this whole change, the whole rise in inequality, closely parallels the coming to power of this free market ideology. And one of the reasons why Americans aren't, I think, fully conscious of what's happened is that we buy into this free market idea. We think that all that's happening is certain shackles being removed from the economy so that you know, the market can operate in its free and pure form. But in fact, markets that are functional are not free. They have to have regulations and rules and enforcement mechanisms and what we're really
that's
talking
government.
About.
That's government.
Yeah, and they definitely make the most of government, but what we're really talking about is a society that is moving towards letting these rules be drafted by insiders with no input from anyone else.
Again, if you just joined us, you're listening to KBOO's Labor Radio. We're talking by phone with James Lardner, who is a journalist, the founder of inequality.org website, and a senior fellow at Demos, a new think tank in New York City. Do you think that this push on their part to sort of seize the media apparatus and get their message out? Do you think that in American society it's been legitimized this inequality that we've seen? I mean, is it less socially unacceptable now than it was maybe 30, 40 years ago?
Yes, Paul Krugman, among others, has pointed to the role of changing social norms. It's not simply a matter of rules; it's a matter of what we accept. One of the essays in our book by Robert Franklin is about this kind of legitimizing of extreme inequality, and we do it in a number of ways. We tell ourselves that people who don't make it in our society, that it's a personal story, a story of their personal failings. We ignore all the social supports that earlier generations of Americans who got ahead had, the GI Bill and the Interstate Highway Program and the tremendous investment in education and housing that built the American middle class in the post-war years. This kind of public investment in equalizing institutions is a historic characteristic of our society, and now it's off the table. It's just not discussed. And that gets us to the second, in my mind, saddest aspect of this tragedy, which is the erosion of democracy. We have now the most important primary in America is not Iowa or New Hampshire or any of those others. It's the so-called wealth primary, which is the unofficial competition to see who can raise the most money in the year before a presidential election.
And I think the media is disgracefully complicit in that they tend to really just heap disrespect on any candidate who doesn't have a war chest, so-called.
Yeah. David K. Johnston, his essay, Charles Lewis's essay, both very good pieces in this book, and maybe I should pause here to say who some of the contributors are.
Yeah, they are some of the leading lights of progressive thinking. Let's hear some of the names.
Bill Moyers, Christopher Jenks, William Grider, Barbara Ehrenreich, Theda Skocpol, Tamara Drought, whom you mentioned, who writes about debt and about higher education and college loans, Eric Warner of the Russell Sage Foundation, Christian Weller of the Center for American Progress, Jim Wallace, whose new book, God's Politics, has been very successful, Meju Louie, Miles Rappaport, who is the president of Demos, and there are about 25 in all.
And each of them have quite distinctive takes on this question as well.
It's partly a matter of distinctive takes, and partly also that what we were trying to do was a stock-taking, you know, and to see how American life had changed in the many dimensions where it has changed as a result of this trend, and we looked for people who had a good take on each of these dimensions.
I wanted to mention Theda Skocpol's piece, which I found quite interesting. Her argument was that, you know, America used to have, going back, you know, 40, 50 more years ago, these kinds of large membership organizations that would sort of teach democracy to ordinary people, not just the rich, but ordinary people. And those have been replaced, she argues, since the 60s and 70s, have become replaced by these kinds of, mailing list advocacy organizations, you know, staffed by well-meaning, but, you know, generally upper-middle-class, well-educated professionals, and there's been a sort of a decline in the traditional kinds of, you know, fraternal associations and membership organizations that would take ordinary people. I learned in this essay, you mentioned the GI Bill. Apparently, the GI Bill was one of the primary accomplishments of the American Legion, which most people don't think of as a rather progressive organization, but it was a membership body of veterans, and they pressed for and won the GI Bill, which is considered one of the, you know, most equalizing laws ever passed in this country.
I didn't know that either. Tocqueville, when he came to this country in the 1830s, wrote about this astonishing collection of civic organizations that existed here, and it was really a phenomenon that flowered in the late 19th, the first half of the 20th century. And as you say, and as Theda Skocpol writes, now these organizations had been displaced by these professionally run, marketing-driven organizations that, where the agenda is written in Washington by a handful of people instead of flowing up from any kind of a membership.
Would Demos.org qualify in that sense?
Well, Demos is based in New York, and it's a pretty diverse crew of people. We have 35 employees. We're not a membership organization. We work with a lot of membership organizations. I think that the real point to note here is that a more unequal society is a society in which there's less of a body of shared experience and shared vocabulary, shared purpose. There are fewer spaces and places and institutions where people gather a wide cross-section of the population gathers, it's more likely to be a place where interests that exercise their influence with money and marketing rather than with the voice of the people.
But there's less of a public sphere in general. There's less public discussion of political ideas. There's less of the idea of the commons now maybe than there used to be. And ever more, it seems to me at least, a growth of the private sphere. You've got walled communities, private schools. I wanted to ask you actually, with this 1% really taking off economically, they don't have to rub shoulders with the rest of us anymore. I mean, do you see the formation of a new aristocratic caste coming, up in the future? Are we going to see in 100 years an America completely unlike what we've known?
I think this is a real danger that we will have a new class of people, you know, clipping coupons and living off dividends or the equivalent of that. And you're right. People don't have to rub shoulders with the masses of Americans. And the one insidious aspect of this is that the value system kind of trickles down. As Bob Frank, the economist Robert Frank, who's the author of The Winner Take All Society and who's one of the contributors to this book, points out, you get some people who spend extravagant amounts of money on housing and on higher education, and it raises the price of admission for everybody else who wants their kids to have a fair shot, or who, you know, you may buy a big house, as he points out, to be in a place with a good school district, which doesn't happen to have any houses that aren't big. But it just drives a whole process of kind of conspicuous consumption, of people investing more than they can afford to in certain things in order to kind of keep up with the very wealthy.
Right, I found that to be one of the more interesting essays. It's sort of like the impacts on the middle class and upper middle class of this takeoff. I mean, if you're trying to keep up with the Joneses, and the Joneses have a net worth of, you know, $10 million, it's going to be very difficult.
Yeah, and it's unfair to do what a lot of critics do, social critics, amateur and professional, you know, and even some parents do it about their children, which is to say, oh, these kids are just so spoiled and self-indulgent that they're spending too much money, you know, they don't have the virtues of us Depression-era, World War II-era Americans. Well, as Bob Frank points out, if you spend a lot of money in order to live in a place with a terrific school system, or in order to get your kids into a good college, you're in this society, the economic pressure on you to do that is very considerable. You know, I wouldn't fault people necessarily here's an example. If it suddenly becomes true that a big percentage of kids are taking expensive SAT prep courses before they take their SATs, that changes the landscape for everybody, like it or not. They're all of these arms race situations.
And even the physical landscape. Now everyone's expected to have perfect teeth, which costs quite a bundle. You really are seeing a difference in so many ways, you know, sickness or lack of sickness. This is a factor of wealth now. James Lardner, we've been talking with, who is one of the editors of Inequality Matters, The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequences. We have just a couple minutes left. I wanted to give you a chance to talk about what are the solutions that folks have come up with in this book. You know, what are the public policy things that we could change, if possible, to address this? Would you, for example, like to see a return to the more progressive taxation? I point out for those listeners who don't know that from the 40s to the about 1970, the top marginal, the top rate on regular income for the wealthiest taxpayers was between 75% and 85%. I mean, I'm guessing that provided somewhat of a break on this sort of runaway incomes by that group.
Progressive taxation in America came in the early part of the 20th century. The income tax itself started during World War I, and for years, for decades, everybody, Republicans, Democrats, agreed that with the concept of progressive taxation, and there is good evidence that it had a big role in making us a more equal society. And by the way, had that effect in other countries. You see the level of economic inequality declining in all of the rich, almost all the rich countries of the world during the years of the Depression, during the years of World War II, which were also years of increasingly progressive taxation and of increasing public investment in programs that supported and created opportunities for people at the bottom of society. And inequality declined in across the developed world, and only in a handful of societies, the United States, more than any other, did this trend reverse, starting in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and to the present. So we're becoming the outlier of the rich nations of the world. We're the one that's drifting towards a third world pattern of income and wealth distribution, and sadly beginning to have some third world-like qualities to our political life as well.
Right, and just maybe into the few seconds that remain, anything that, you know, if somehow, I don't know. Actually, let me ask you this. Do you think either of the major parties, cares about this issue, the inequality issue, economically?
I think that it's not a given that either party will rise to the occasion. The Democratic Party is in a somewhat better position to do so, having been out of power, either literally out of power, or kind of out of power as it was through part of the Clinton years, even though it had a Democrat in the White House, for so long that, of course, it's the party better poised to take on this question. But what makes it so tough is that everybody in our political life now, both parties are dependent on money, huge sums of money to get people into office, and the huge sums of money have to come from millionaires. That's just the way it is when you get to this volume of spending. And this isn't, you know, talking about inequality is not, it does not always go over well with your contributors.
Maybe with your small contributors it might, though. I mean, I think some would argue that the reason the Democrats have done poorly, I mean, for a lot of folks in the blue-collar working class, they really feeling betrayed and abandoned over the years by the Democratic Party, and seeing them as becoming indistinguishable from the Republican Party on issues of inequality and trade, for example, above all.
I see grounds for hope in the success of the living wage campaigns around the country, and also just in the fact that this whole new economic rule book has been put into place by deception. So much was mislabeled, so much was done on the sly in the small print of deregulation bills, and I think it happened this way because the people who put these policies through suspected, I believe rightly, that if Americans had really known what was up, there would have been a cry of protest, there would be a cry of protest, and that if there were a cry of protest, things would change, despite all of the deformities of our democracy these days. And in fact, we see in societies with far less democracy than we have, when masses of people have raised a cry of protest in Eastern Europe after the fall of communism, or at the time of the fall of communism in South Africa about apartheid, things have changed. So this should give us hope. But first, people need to find their voices and their consciences. There's just so much cynicism in America today, and I think part of the process, aside from policies, there are many policies that we can move towards that would create greater equality, but part of what's needed is just a liberation from the whole free market idea, from the idea of powerlessness, that there's nothing we can do about these things because they are driven by deep impersonal forces. That's the bill of goods we have been sold by too many experts.
James Lardner, I want to thank you for joining us this evening on Labor Radio.
Thank you.
Again, James Lardner, editor of Inequality Matters, The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequences. You can check that book out online, inequality.org, or purchase a copy at our own Union bookstore here in Portland, Powells.com, or one of the Powells locations. Again, James, thank you.
Good night.
Up ahead, actually, we have our second part of the Demos Forum evening. Demos meaning people in Greek. This show being Labor Radio for working people. This is an interview that was recorded a week and a half ago. Tamara Drought appeared last week in Portland to talk about her book, Strapped, Why America's 20-somethings and 30-somethings Can't Seem to Get Ahead. I think we'll cue that up right now and come back at the end with some announcements. We're joined by Tamara Drought, author of Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. Tamara Drought, for those who may not be familiar with her, is a researcher with the Demos organization, a think tank based in New York City. Looking at progressive ideas for a new America. She's been a frequent guest on CNN, CNBC, and so forth, and now apparently on Labor Radio on KBOO FM Portland. Tamara Drought, welcome to Labor Radio.
Thanks for having me.
You're the author of this just-released book now, Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. What made you decide to do this book?
You know, a couple reasons. I think that there's a lot of frustration out there among young people and among the parents of young people about why it seems that a whole generation is really struggling economically. And I think that it was time to tell a new story, because I think that for too long we've sort of dismissed the economic challenges facing this generation of young adults as sort of chalking it up to frivolous spending and not being able to budget, when in reality they're really dealing with the fallout of, you know, 3-decade-long shift in our public policy priorities and shifting risk from society to the individual. And it's really these big structural issues that are making it so much difficult for young people to work or educate their way into the middle class.
So, I mean, I guess I kind of wanted to establish that a little bit. I mean, how can we say that it's more difficult today for 20 or 30-somethings to get ahead? I mean, after all, sometimes it's difficult to sort of compare apples and oranges. The expectations are probably higher today in some respects in terms of lifestyle, right?
Well, let's start with the basics, which is income. How much is the typical 25 to 34-year-old earning compared to a generation ago? If you look at college grads, they're earning about the same. After you adjust for inflation.
Actually, your book has them, I think, earning a couple thousand less, doesn't it?
Yeah, it depends on what years you look at. They've either stayed in place or actually have seen a decline over the last 30 years. And then so that's college grads. And keep in mind all of the things that have grown much quicker than inflation, the cost of things like housing and health care and college. Then when we look at young people who don't have four-year degrees, they've really gotten slammed in the labor market and are making about 10 grand less after adjusting for inflation than they would have a generation ago. So right there, just in terms of what young people are earning today in this labor market, sets them up for having a much more difficult time sort of getting on their feet and getting ahead.
Now, in terms of those dollar comparisons, again, you're using constant dollars in your book. Is that for, like, what, 2005 value or something like that?
I think it's 2002 or 2003, depending on when the data was available.
I guess, you know, I'm not skeptical necessarily of those kinds of comparisons, but it is, I think, probably a little bit difficult to say, you know, what a dollar is worth. And there's a little bit of controversy over this, you know, cost of living increases and how that's calculated. Have you looked into that at all?
I think that's a pretty standard, you know, using the CPI to adjust dollars for inflation. You know, that's how we calculate any change over time is using that. So I'm not worried about the numbers being different. I think most people understand that if you're adjusting salaries for inflation over time, that's the only way we have to do it is to put everything in constant dollars. So.
Right, not to dwell on the subject, but I just I certainly, you know, understand that economists accept this as a pretty standard measurement. But I know that sometimes conservatives will argue that, well, you know, maybe it's true that this constant dollar comparison is the case. But what about accommodating differences in quality? For example, you know, maybe the dollar could buy a TV in 1954 and it could buy a TV in 2006, but the TV is a lot better, or something to that effect.
Right, but the important thing here is that when we look at things that really determine the quality of life in this country, the ability to raise your kids in a decent neighborhood with good schools, the ability to have health care, the ability to get the education that you need to compete in today's economy, all of those things have gotten much, much more expensive. And the public policy supports that used to make it more possible and accessible have all declined. So it doesn't really matter what, you know, even if earnings, let's say, just stayed in place, the fact that we now have cheap electronics is really of no help when, you know, parents are spending $12,000 a year for child care and they're taking on credit card debt because we're the only nation that doesn't have paid family leave. And we have college students leaving with $20,000 in student loan debt in order to get this bachelor's degree that now has become sort of the minimum ticket required to get into the middle class.
Right, and so in your book, you know, wages is just really the starting point. You talk about debt as a new phenomenon that many young people are heavily in debt for a variety of reasons. We'll go into it in a minute. You know, and then also the basic you know quality of life things you need to buy are evidently more expensive as well. Housing and education in particular.
Absolutely. Well, let's just start with education. You know. The two things have happened over the last couple decades. One, the era of sort of cheap state college tuition is gone. States have been steadily declining the percentage of their budgets that they spend to support higher education, and schools have been raising tuition in response to that and in response to the fact that there's a lot more demand out there for a college degree. At the same time, at the federal level, in terms of financial aid, we've seen a sea change in how we help people afford college, and we moved away from providing grants, which don't have to be repaid, to providing loans. And let me just give you one example. You know, back in the late 1970s, you could get a Pell Grant, which is the primary vehicle for helping low-income students afford college. That Pell Grant in the late 1970s would have covered three-quarters of the cost of going to a four-year college. Today, it covers about a third. So we've really declined, seen a real decline in our commitment to funding things like higher education in this country. And as a result, we are now making less progress than we did a generation ago in terms of the class divide and the race divide in terms of who goes to college.
In case you joined us late, you're listening to Labor Radio on KBOFM. We're talking with Tamara Drought, author of the just-released Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. You know, this tuition issue is a pretty interesting one in so many respects. You know, it is, I think, for many occupations now expected that you have...
Kate, is there a room?
Uh-oh. Tamara, are you with us?
Yep.
Okay. Maybe we've got someone else on the line, a little technical snafu. Hopefully it won't bother us more. Here we go. Basically, you know, it's expected for so many people that they have a bachelor's degree. Now, in your book, you say that we're still only looking at like 29-30% of young people are getting college degrees. What does that mean for those who don't have them?
Well, it means that they're going to have a much more difficult time getting into the middle class and earning a decent wage. You know, one of the things that's happened is we've lost the good-paying manufacturing jobs that used to make it possible for an accountant and a steel worker to raise their kids in the same neighborhood and enjoy the same quality of life in terms of health care and pension benefits. That's no longer the case. You know, those jobs are being replaced with low-wage service sector jobs that, by the way, aren't unionized. So one of the things I talk about in the book is we have got to figure out a way to make these better-paying jobs, and I think putting some enforcement behind the legal right for workers to unionize their workplace definitely has to happen.
Yeah, let's kind of maybe we'll wrap up our little conversation today with some talk about solutions. I do want to get kind of more into some of the details of just how hard people are having to work just to stay in place at some level. You know, tuition, you mentioned up and up and up at, you know, the state, these were the affordable colleges, were the state supported colleges. You know, if I'm not mistaken, the University of California you know, tuition was zero in the 1960s. Like, basically,
yep.
This was a free public education, the idea being it benefits society. It's not always easy to get in, but, you know, once you're in there, this is something that society is going to invest in.
Training
its people, educating
its
people.
The last decade or so.
And so, do you happen to know what it is now in California?
No, I don't, but I do know that people are getting priced out, absolutely.
I I look at my own experience, too. When I started, I started college at University of Oregon in 1988, tuition was then $550, which was quite high for me. Now I understand at the same university you're looking at something like $1,500, $1,600.
Right.
For one term.
Yeah,
and
it's more than doubled.
And that's just tuition, of course. You know, college
right.
students still have to pay for other things that, you know, they
right.
need to live as well.
Right, absolutely. Today, you know, the average cost of going to a four-year state college, room, board, tuition, is a little over $11,000. Now, to put that in perspective, that's about what it used to cost, again, adjusted for inflation, to go to a private school 30 years ago. So the burden is just enormous that students face and families face, and as a result, young people are working longer hours than before in college. They're dropping out in droves. You know, 40% of all college freshmen drop out after their first year. And a lot of these kids don't even make it in the door in the first place. These are, you know, smart kids that come from modest economic backgrounds. They're college ready, and they're not able to scrape together enough loans or money to foot the bill. They downscale their dreams. They either forgo college altogether or they go to community college and often burn out from the burden of working full-time and going to school full-time.
So I would think that between tuition and debt that it could be pretty daunting for a person, you know, of very modest means, looking at trying to use higher education as an economic ladder.
Right. And also keep in mind that, you know, even going to college today is no guarantee of getting ahead. You know, there are a lot of young professionals that are buckling under the weight of these student loan debts and trying to piece together careers which still are clustered in our nation's most expensive cities. So it definitely is the best path to take, and we've got real equity issues in terms of, you know, a lot of people will argue, well, not everybody needs to go to college, but we live in a country where anybody who wants to go to college should be able to go to college.
Well, I guess the question is also what's the role of college, too, and that's for maybe another discussion. But I feel like something's changing in this society in a couple of ways. I mean, certainly there are some occupations which are sort of which require a kind of technical training. And what's interesting to me is that the employers that are seeking that aren't willing, as they maybe used to have been in the past, to actually foot the bill for that. So the individuals have to go into debt, have to you know, foot the bill for their own training to become job ready,
right.
And then they're at the mercy of the job market, whatever it is when they get out. Now there's a whole other cast of folks, you know, the sort of maybe the folks that go into the liberal arts or the Bachelor of Arts degree, where it's almost difficult to justify the expense in terms of the academic outcome of those degrees. And I think it's more of an expectation of a kind of a socialization experience that you've had. This you know, you're a middle class person who can show up on time or that kind of thing. You know, who can stick with something for a few years. As opposed to actually being required for your job. I mean, there's so many occupations where, you know, they expect you to have a bachelor's and they don't care what it's in.
Right. And, you know, we have to remember that the monetary awards to college are just one of the benefits. You know, there's also a huge reward to our democracy and our society. We live in a ever-increasing complex world. And the basic critical thinking, reasoning skills that you get with a bachelor's degree are more and more important to navigating in our country and to our democracy. You know, there's real differences in political participation between those who go to college and those who don't. So it's not only vital for our economy, it's really vital to the health of our democracy that we are educating people to the fullest of their abilities.
So, Beck, I'm thinking you're 18, you've got some choices to make. If you go to college, unless you're already independently wealthy, your parents are going to help you out, you know, you're going to end up with quite a bit of debt when you get out, and that's going to be a burden to start out your work life. If you don't go to college, then you're facing probably a significant decrease in your earning power, you know, relative to your parents or grandparents' generation. Now, what happens when you get out of college, and all of a sudden you're being wooed by credit card companies, and you kind of might like to get started in the work world, and you've got this debt to pay off, and gee, it'd be nice to buy a house, but that's sort of a pipe dream, and you know, maybe you'd like to have a kid before your ovaries give out. You know, let's talk about some of those issues and how things are different for young people today.
Well, I mean, I think you just sort of covered the whole experience of being a young person, and that is, you know, if you think of the path to adulthood as being an obstacle course made up of hurdles, each hurdle has gotten progressively higher and riskier in terms of navigating for this generation. You know, it starts with trying to get an education, and you either come out with an enormous debt burden, or you don't make it through because dropped the public supports that made it possible to graduate without debt and allow low-income people to afford the cost of college. Then you hit the labor market, and again, you know, we've seen the decline of unions, so people without college degrees working in the service sector are making, you know, $7, $8 an hour, where a generation ago they could have worked in a steel factory and made $17, $18 an hour and had benefits. Then we look at what's happened in the housing market, and this is an area where young professionals particularly are caught between a rock and a hard place. And that's because when it comes to the job markets for college-educated young people, they still tend to be clustered around our nation's largest, most expensive cities. So young people need to go where the jobs are, and that often means taking on rents that are much larger than what the generation previously had to deal with. You know, one out of three young people are spending more than 30% of their income on housing. That's up from one in five a generation ago. And they're also spending, when they're ready to move into a home, they are taking on much bigger mortgages in order to get a house in a good school district.
Now, why do you think that is? What's changed? Why is you think housing is more expensive relative to income and so forth than it used to be? And any theories as to why?
Well, you know, a lot of people will point to the fact that there's a lot more demand. You know, there were a lot of baby boomers who needed homes in good neighborhoods with good school districts, and they had the purchasing power to really bargain up those prices. You know, the reality is you're not just buying a home, you're buying a school district. And so whenever that happens, the ability to start bidding wars is always going to be an issue. And the reality is home values in good school districts are much, much, much higher than those in good public school districts. So that's the issue here. I mean, people are really chasing down a good school when they're looking for a home.
So they're shackled by tuition debt. It took me 10 years to pay off mine. I don't know if you're still paying yours off. How old are you?
34.
And
I'm paying off grad school debt.
Oh, you are? Okay, very good. So you know from personal experience what the things you write. And then maybe if you're lucky enough to be able to come up with a down payment somehow, you're potentially looking at half your income going to, in many cases, and going to the mortgage. What about credit card debt? Now, this, I guess I have my own analysis of that. You know, basically easy credit at high interest rates, made available to you. Meanwhile, we're the most marketed to probably generation in history. Mm-hmm. Those folks aren't spending that advertising and marketing money for nothing. They know that it's going to stimulate the desire for their products. All of a sudden, you just have to have whatever the next thing is, and that goes on the credit card, perhaps?
Well, I think there's a couple things. One, I think material expectations are definitely higher, and yes, the credit card industry spends billions of dollars promoting the product. But the credit industry and the rise in credit card debt has also been facilitated by this major economic crunch that people are in. You know, the reality is when you graduate school with $20,000 in student loan debt and you're only making $30,000 and you live in a high-cost city, you're not going to be able to make all your bills on time. You're going to have to turn to credit to fill the gaps, and that's indeed what young people are doing. You know, the car breaks down. It goes on a credit card. They need to buy a suit for an interview. That goes on the credit card, particularly for young people who can't turn to their parents for help with these types of things. So a lot of credit card debt gets built up just trying to, start their adult lives. And then, of course, yes, we have been flooded and marketed to, and, we all could stand to go on a pretty big consumption diet. But there are also some other, I think, economic and structural issues at work here as well.
Let's talk about some of the changes that have taken place in the workplace. And by the way, if you've joined us late, again, you're listening to Labor Radio on KBOO FM. We're talking with Tamara Drought, author of Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. You talk about sort of a new job market that very different than what maybe our parents or the parents of young people or their grandparents might have experienced. Bouncers, jugglers, tempsters, and pajamas, these are some terms that you may have invented. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. Well, one of the things that's happening to young people is, let's start with bouncers. They move around a lot more. The idea of loyalty to one company is gone. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. The problem is that each new job no longer pays off in terms of a boost to your paycheck the way it used to. I think the easiest way to think about this is if you think of a generation ago when a young person entered the labor market, they were on an escalator. They could count on this sort of steady and swift progression in earnings. Today, when young people enter the labor market, they're on an automated airport walkway. They're just staying in place. They're not making as much out of the gates, and their earnings aren't growing as quickly as they would have a generation ago. So in search of an ever-increasing paycheck, young people are much more likely to move from job to job over shorter time periods. Jugglers are basically, people who are juggling work and school. And that has really become, we still think of the typical college student today as sort of living on campus, working part-time, going to school full-time. That is no longer the reality. If you look at, the percentage of kids going to college, 45% of them are in community colleges. They're working full-time. They're taking courses full-time. So they're juggling work and school and often not making it through in terms of schooling. And then the tempsters and pajamas really reflect the reality that, today our economy is much more reliant on temporary and freelance labor than it used to be. And young adults tend to make up the biggest percentage of that new class of workers.
And the pajamas, I guess, that's the those are the telecommuters.
Work from home.
Right.
Yeah.
You can work in your pajamas. But
yep.
But you may be very likely a freelancer. You're an independent contractor. Gosh, maybe not even Social Security or, depending on your arrangement, but
right,
probably not your
right.
traditional benefit package and so forth.
Right. Trying to buy health care in the free market. I mean, most freelancers don't have health care because it is so expensive to buy an individual plan in the free market.
You know, given this this shift and, you know, more difficulties faced by young people today, why do you suppose young workers aren't rising up? You know, nothing to lose but their credit card debt, for example.
But they're
not necessarily as political maybe as the young people of a previous generation.
They absolutely aren't, and they were raised not to be. You know, young people today really came of age during the 1980s and early 1990s when, you know, there was never a positive thing said about the role of government in people's lives. And they were never taught to believe that the personal is political the way the previous generation did. So what we have is a whole generation of young people who, when they're struggling, look internally, think about the decisions that they could have made differently. And as a result, don't connect what's happening in their friends' lives, their family members' lives, to the larger political economic system. So they've tuned out of politics. They don't vote in as high numbers as older generations. And they just haven't been brought up to think in the same way the previous generations did. And, you know, if I accomplish anything with my book, my hope is to really get young people to start questioning the system and not just themselves.
Yeah, I guess I have a couple of my own pair of theories maybe to account for this too. I mean, I think, you know, there is this, you know, you discussed this in the book to the sort of the Reaganization hypothesis, you know, that they've been subjected to in many cases, you know, a decade or more of Republican rule or perhaps misrule, but Republican ideology basically being kind of the dominant language. You know, and I guess what strikes me is that it hasn't had more of an impact in making young people actually conservative. It's just kept them from being political more. And I think to me, I guess the things that I look to are this sort of the question about, you know, hopelessness. I mean, if they've never seen victory, for example, for a kind of a progressive thing that they might be sympathetic to, they're less likely to want to put their own energy into it. If they don't see necessarily an opposition party that gives them something to believe in, then they're less likely to get involved in that as well. This is just maybe my own. I look at trying to think about the differences between the generations. If you look at these, like a movie or you read about the 60s generation, the baby boom generation, they're so earnest, they're so serious. They engage with their political environment, but you don't see the kind of irony that I think that maybe, you know, us moderns, 20 somethings, 30 somethings, are sort of ironic, but in a way I think that ultimately ends up making it difficult to express serious ideas and advocate in our interest. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Well, yeah, I think that young people have been paralyzed out of thinking that they can affect change. I mean, some of it's real. You know, the power of money in politics right now, I think, leads a lot of people to be very cynical about their ability to influence the political process, and rightly so. However, we've got to start trying because, you know, there's this vicious cycle where politicians don't pay attention to young people because they don't vote, and young people don't pay attention to politicians because they don't talk to their needs. Well, I can tell you the elected officials aren't going to all of a sudden wake up and start paying attention to young people. It's really, we have to be the agent for change, and so we need to start speaking up, voting, sending emails to Congress members, protesting the state of affairs today, and know that over time change is absolutely possible. But I think you're right. This is a generation that has been ridiculed and infantilized since, you know, they were coming of age. They were slackers. You know, I just think that we've been told that we don't have any power and that anything that is wrong is our own fault. And that's a paralyzing way to grow up.
But I think there might be something too qualitatively different about the political system today, and don't know how much credence you give to the utterances of Ralph Nader, but I remember a few years ago listening to him, and you know, he had this idea that in the 60s, you know, his public interest groups would publish some report, or they'd make some press conference, and the press would come and report on it, and there'd be public outrage, and the elected members of Congress would do something about it. They would pass some reform, and they had all these a series of reforms, even passed under Republican President Nixon, for example. You know, nowadays those same groups are out there. They're still having the press conferences. They're still publishing the reports. In some cases, the media is still reporting on it, but nothing happens. There's something's happened to our political system that's maybe both parties are now sort of bought out, or there's less difference, or something's happening to prevent the kinds of change that you did see happen in previous generations from happening today.
I think there are a lot of factors at work, and I think that the corruption, the corruptive influence of money in our politics is definitely a major difference between the way it was when you know, Nader first started his public interest groups. Absolutely.
You close your book by laying out an agenda for reform, and I wanted to give you a chance to share some of your ideas for how to get society to boost opportunities for young people.
Well, I think there's a couple really critical things. One, we've got to end the debt for diploma system. It isn't working. Not only does it strangle young people with way too much debt when they enter the real world, it keeps too many bright kids from getting on that path to begin with. So we've got to switch back to more grants and be less reliant on loans. And states have got to commit to funding higher education. A couple other things we need to do. You know, the United States is the only industrialized nation in the world that doesn't offer paid family leave or any type of subsidized child care. These are real issues facing young people. You know, it's the under 34 crowd. It's at that age when you're getting married and starting a family. And a lot of young parents are going deep into debt as a result of having a child and no supports to help them navigate this major, major transition in the new reality that both parents need to work. The other thing we need to do is we need to create more good jobs, and that means facilitating union organizing and also investing more in career ladder programs so that people who aren't on a four-year college track can move up in their occupation and work toward a decent living wage.
Right, this union idea, there's a, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with Andy Stern, the head of SEIU, has been, you know, pushing this idea of taking the jobs that are here and making them good jobs. And the same, like the service industry jobs, for example, there's no reason, you know,
Absolutely.
Automatically that they should have to be low-paying jobs. It's just that those workers aren't organized. They don't have any, you know,
That's
organized
exactly
way
right.
to fight for their own interests. And so if there's a way, for example, a bill in Congress to make it easier to unionize, something like that actually might help turn the tide for young
Congress,
people. Yeah,
that would make it easier to organize. Absolutely. You know, the first round of the middle class was built by public investment and strong unions. And the second wave of middle class expansion needs to be fueled by the exact same things. You know, what made those manufacturing jobs good jobs were that they were organized and had collective bargaining. And that just doesn't exist today. There's no reason why the service sector jobs that have replaced those jobs need to be such low paying and of poor quality as they are now.
Again, we've been talking with Tamara Drought, author of Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-something Can't Get Ahead. Tamara, any final thoughts for our listeners? Maybe include the website of your organization, DMOS.
Sure. They can find out more information on the book's website, strappedthebook.com, in terms of how to get involved. It's easy to use the power of the internet today to make your voice heard. And I think the stakes are high. I think we as a generation are going to, you know, 30 years from now be known as the generation that saved the American dream or the one who lived through its demise.
Tamara Drought, it's been a pleasure having you on Labor Radio.
Thanks. Take care.
Thanks for joining us.
Again, that was an interview recorded Friday before last with Tamara Drought, who was in Portland at that point. I do have one announcement to make for those who may be interested. A presentation on Latin America's shift to the left. That's not tomorrow, but the following Tuesday. It's an update from Brazil. They're bringing in a representative of Brazil's landless workers movement, Andrea Borges Ferreira. I'm just making a stab at that pronunciation. That's, again, Tuesday, March 7th at 7 p.m. at Liberty Hall in North Portland. That's 311 North Ivy Street, and that's one block south of Fremont, two blocks west of Vancouver Avenue. Again, Tuesday after next, an update from Brazil. I'd like to thank our engineer, Ben Levine, and we hope that you'll join us again the following Monday at 6 p.m. for Labor Radio. Host Bill Zimmerman will be talking with the head of the New York Working Families Party, Dan Cantor, about the Working Families Party idea. He'll also have Barbara Dudley here in Portland talking about how they're forming a Working Families Party for Oregon. That's, again, this Monday, this coming Monday at 6 p.m. Stay tuned. Stay tuned now for Time Sound, a program of soul music with host Kevin Berry.
Possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. And also by AFSCME Local 3336, representing the employees of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality by advocating for working conditions, pay and benefits, supporting political activity that promotes pro-environment and pro-labor positions, strengthening labor coalitions, and actively organizing members. More information at AFSCME3336.org.
I've a backward kind of basic need. I get my kicks when I don't succeed, because I've got the will to fail. I seem to make an effort, but I never do connect. And while I'm very rational, I'm seldom, if ever, practically never correct, because I've got the will to fail. The will to fail. I secretly am enjoying myself, but slowly I'm destroying myself. I think I got a tiger by the tail, a tiger called the will.